Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we are started last week to study the greater discourse on the destruction of craving. This is the Maha Tanha Sankhya Sutta, Sutta number 38 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this sutta begins when a monk by the name of Sati propounds the view, what's called the pernicious view, that it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another. Then the monks hear about this view and they criticize him and explain to him that the Buddha has always taught that consciousness is dependently arisen and consciousness always arises through conditions. It never arises without a condition. Sati refuses to give up his view. Eventually the monks bring him to the Buddha. The Buddha again repeats. The Buddha makes him explain more precisely what he means by his view about consciousness, to what he understands by this same consciousness. And then he explains that what he understands by consciousness, and that's the important point, is that he understands by consciousness that it is that which speaks, feels, and experiences here and there the result of good and bad deeds. So in other words, that consciousness he takes to be a kind of persisting self or subject. And this is, of course, a view of self, a kind of atmavada, which is exactly what the Buddha has rejected in his teaching. And so the Buddha again criticizes him, points out that he's storing up much demerit by grasping this wrong view. And then the Buddha explains how he teaches that there are these six types of consciousness, that is eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness, each type arising through its own set of conditions. Amongst these conditions, the most important are the object condition and the sense faculty condition. And it is the sense faculty condition that determines consciousness to be consciousness of a particular type. And last week I said that this might seem to give, to imply, if we take this passage superficially, it might seem to imply a kind of view that since each consciousness depends on its own conditions, one might think that the mind consciousness also depends on the body, and so when the body passes away at death, consciousness comes to an end. And so for the Buddha, there's no survival of consciousness. But actually, according to the Buddha's teaching, as I said, I use the expression that consciousness is the kind of, I call it the vehicle or channel for the rebirth process. Even though there's no persisting individual consciousness, that goes on is the same entity. And the sutta where we find this idea of consciousness as the channel for the rebirth process stated very clearly is the great discourse on causation, the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. Okay, here the Buddha is in a dialogue with the Venerable Ananda. And he's explaining the different links in the chain of dependent origination. And he's explaining how consciousness is the condition for nama-rupa, mentality, materiality. And he says, how this is so should be understood in this way. If consciousness does not descend into the mother's womb, then nama-rupa doesn't take shape in the womb. And if consciousness, after descending into the womb, were to depart, then nama-rupa would not be generated, would not come into this present state of being. And if the consciousness of a young boy or girl were to be cut off, then nama-rupa, name and form, would not grow up, develop, and reach maturity. And so from this we could see that consciousness has a kind of, we could call it a fundamental role as, we could call it the most basic of the five aggregates. We call it the underlying support of the whole personal existence. But this consciousness always depends upon other factors, and it doesn't have any independent existence. And so even though consciousness goes on from life to life, but it's always changing, it doesn't remain the same consciousness for two consecutive moments, but it's always arising and then passing away and re-arising as a new moment of consciousness, then passing away, re-arising, passing away, arising. And whenever it arises supported by conditions. And of the six types of consciousness, obviously the five types of sense consciousness, physical sense consciousness, they cannot serve as the support for the rebirth consciousness because the five sense faculties come to an end at death. But it is a type of manovijnana that serves as the base or support for the rebirth process. In the suttas, the nikayas, the details of the way the rebirth process occurs are not worked out in any kind of technical detail. This is what is worked out in the different, first in the different Abhidharma schools, one way in the Theravada Abhidharma, another way in the Sarvastivada Abhidharma, then some of the other schools develop different explanations, then the Yogacara school, the later one of the schools of Mahayana philosophy, then brought in the idea of the store consciousness, alaya vijnana, which is also called the receptacle consciousness, to explain the continuity of consciousness from life to life. The store consciousness is considered to be the type of consciousness that stores up all of the seeds of past experience and all of the karmic formations or karmic accumulations. But the early Buddhist teachings and even the early Mahayana teachings work with a system of only six types of consciousness. Okay, I said last week that in the sutta, the Buddha will demonstrate the conditionality of consciousness from about three different angles. And now this conditionality of consciousness in arising through sense base or through sense object and sense faculty, that is only the first way of demonstrating the conditionality of consciousness. But other methods will come in as the sutta develops. Okay, now after this treatment of consciousness in paragraph 8, in paragraph 9, the Buddha seems to introduce a new topic. He raises a question. He says, Bhikkhus, do you see this has come to be? In Pali, also, it's a little bit obscure. Bhutami dung ti bhikkhave pasata ti. And I have to say, I don't know how the monks could have understood what he was talking about without some kind of hint or indication. But somehow they got the idea. But now, according to the commentary, what is meant here by this is the combination of the five aggregates in their totality. So here, what is being done is to broaden the scope of the analysis or the scope of the investigation. So in the previous paragraph, the Buddha is treating only the conditionality of consciousness, and treating the conditionality of consciousness only in terms of each moment of consciousness arising through its object and sense base. But now the Buddha is taking all the five aggregates together and saying, do you see how this, that is all the five aggregates, have come into being? How they are originated. Something that have... And when you say that they have come into being, this means that they are not something which have existed forever, which have not existed through an eternal past, but they have come into existence. And then in the second question, he says, do you see that its origination occurs with that as nutriment? That is, he's saying, or asking, do you see that this compound of the five aggregates originates through specific conditions, that it has different types of nutriment? And then he asked, do you see that with the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation? And they say, yes, sir. These questions, they seem very, very simple, but the implications are very, very profound. This is really almost like a restatement of the famous verse that the monk Asaji spoke to Sariputta at their first meeting, the verse through which Sariputta gained his first understanding of the Dhamma, that whatever phenomena there are that originate through causes, the Tathagata has explained their causes and also their cessation. That is what the great ascetic teaches. Okay, so here first we have the five aggregates. And then they have their nutriment. And now we know that, in fact, we're going to learn again just on the next page, that there are four nutriments according to the Buddha's teaching. What are the four nutriments? How are they translated here? Okay. Maybe call it edible food, contact, mental volition, and consciousness. Okay, so we try to connect these four types of nutriment with the five aggregates. For the aggregate of form, what is the main condition, the main type of nutriment? Right. Edible food would be the main condition. And feeling. Perception. Yeah, contact also for perception. For volitional formations. Mental volition actually is the volitional form. Yeah. It is contact too. Then, okay, three. For consciousness, what is that? From one angle, one could say that. Actually, I think you see what's said is that nama rupa is the main condition for consciousness, and in nama rupa, one has contact, mental volition. So you could say certainly these two, certainly contact, mental volition are conditions for consciousness. And even one could say that the consciousness at not at the same time, but from one moment, at one moment, the consciousness is a nutriment for the consciousness at another moment. So consciousness is always feeding consciousness. So we could say even the consciousness is a nutriment for consciousness. Okay, the next few paragraphs are intended to show how the Buddha expects his monks not to just accept this on trust from him, but to see this and to penetrate it, he says, with correct wisdom. And generally this abandoning of doubt about this and seeing it, these things as they really are with correct wisdom. This is really achieved, I would say, in my understanding, fully only by a stream enterer, a sotapanna. Okay, and then in paragraph 14, the Buddha gives some important words of advice. He says, purified and bright as this view is, if you adhere to it, cherish it, treasure it, and treat it as a possession that is grasp it, then would you be understanding that the Dhamma has been taught as similar to a raft, that is being for the purpose of crossing over and not for the purpose of grasping. And then the monks say, no, venerable sir. And then the Buddha says, if you do not adhere to it, cherish it, treasure it, treat it as a possession, would you then understand that the Dhamma has been taught as similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping? And the monks say, yes, venerable sir. Okay, what is the Buddha referring to here? To what? Right, it's the famous simile of the raft that we took last month, was it? In the Alagadupama Sutta. So he's saying that, well, he's just referring back to that same simile. So it seems that the simile was already quite well known. And so the point here, now the statement is being made not with regard to the Dhamma as a whole, but specifically it's being made with regard to, we call this samaditti, to right view. And he's not saying that one gets rid of right view and doesn't hold to any views at all. But rather, what he's saying is that one adopts a right view, this purified and bright view, but one uses it sort of pragmatically or instrumentally as a means for crossing over, that is, for crossing from this near shore, which is supposed to be dangerous and fearful, crossing over the river of ignorance and craving, the floods of the defilements, to cross over to the far shore of Nibbana, which is safe and secure. Okay, now what I call this general questionnaire on being has extended the scope of conditionality from consciousness alone, which is the focus of paragraph 8. Now it's broadened the range of conditionality to take in all five aggregates, which are summed up in this word, this. This has come to be through nutriment. And since consciousness is included within the five aggregates, this also shows that consciousness has come to be through a condition. And what's important to realize also, I should mention, that these four nutriments, especially these three, are not existing outside the five aggregates. They are part of the five aggregates themselves. And even edible food, though it starts off maybe outside of our own five aggregate, our own form aggregate, but when we eat it, when it starts turning into the nutrients get metabolized, then they become part of our own rupa kanda, part of our own form body. And so they become part of the five aggregates. And so all of the four nutriments are also within the five aggregates. And so we could say that this process of origination through nutriment is a process by which the five aggregates are continually nourishing themselves through a kind of internal process of conditioned origination. It's just that the material body depends upon a source of food, water, air that's originally outside the body, but it gets absorbed into the body and then assimilated to the body, integrated into the body. Integrated with the body. Integrated with the body. Okay, now we come to paragraph 15. And here the Buddha returns to this theme. Or maybe I should just pause here and ask if there are any questions relating to this passage on nutriment.
George? You mentioned before the sutta in the Digha Nikaya that had reference to rebirth as consciousness.
That spoke about the way consciousness functions as what I call the channel for the rebirth process.
Which number was that?
Yeah, it's Digha Nikaya number 15, the Mahanidana Sutta. Yeah, Suki?
Mahanidana puzzles me. When you say in that sutta, consciousness connect to the next rebirth, is in Pali, is it vijnana or is it citta?
No, the Mahanidana uses the word vijnana because it's speaking how vijnana is the condition for nama-rupa. So it's using these terms from the chain of dependent origination.
Then where is the function of the sankhara? I always thought once we end present life,
yeah,
what connects to next life is rather sankhara than the vijnana. That's what I thought.
We're going to come to dependent origination soon, so let us not deal with questions about that now. Okay, then we'll go on to taking up paragraph 15. Okay, here the Buddha introduces the four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance or sustenance of beings that have come to be and for the support of those seeking a new existence. Okay, what are the four? They are physical food, or we call it edible food, gross or subtle, contact as the second, mental volition as the third and consciousness as the fourth. Okay, then he raises the question, these four kinds of nutriment, what is their source? What is their origin? From what are they born and produced? And then he gives the answer. He says, these four kinds of nutriment have craving as their source, craving as their origin. They are born and produced from craving. Okay, I had explained this in dealing with the sutta on samaditti, but I'll go over it again. Okay, I would understand this relationship, how craving is the source or cause for the four types of nutriment in two ways. One I call the common sense way, and the other, maybe going to a deeper angle, I don't know what term to call it, metaphysical way, but it's not metaphysical. Okay, the common sense way is that it is craving that turns these four objects or four entities into objects for nourishing the life process. That we say that for any being, any living being, even for a liberated one, an arhant, there are these four types of nutriment, but it is craving that makes them supporting or sustaining factors for this process of continued existence. That's craving that makes food into an object of, you know, attraction, that turns it into something one is constantly seeking. Delicious food, tasty food, different exotic food. Now one wants to go to, one hasn't gone to a Spanish restaurant, Italian restaurant, Japanese restaurant, I've never been to a Korean restaurant. What? No, joking. Kimchi too hot anyway. Then through craving, one is always seeking new feelings. So then one has to get feeling, one has to experience different contacts. Contact with this to get new sensations, different sensations. I haven't experienced this, haven't experienced that. I have to go to this nightclub for this sensation. Listen to this music to get that sensation. Okay, then craving that turns mental volition into a nutriment. I have these plans, these projects, these designs, these aspirations, intentions. I'm going to get my will. That's whether I have to knock down mountains, swim across oceans. And then consciousness also is the craving to experience this, experience that. To know the experience, there has to be consciousness. So craving turns it all into sort of, craving turns consciousness into the instrument or means for experiencing all of these different objects of enjoyment. Okay, that's what I call the common sense way in which craving is a cause for these four things to become nutriments or sustaining factors for this process of becoming, process of repeated existence. Okay, and that is one level in which it can be understood. Okay, the second level, this is the way it's explained in the commentaries which are based on the Abhidhamma. And they explain that craving is the condition for these four nutriments in the sense that it is the craving from the previous existence that brings about a new existence, that brings about this existence. And when craving brings about this new existence, it brings into being these four types of nutriment, even from the very first moment of life, the very moment when consciousness springs up, in the case of a human rebirth, from the very first moment when consciousness springs up in the mother's womb. At that moment of conception, the process of nutrition begins. There's that, even the one-celled, fertilized egg, the ovum, is already, as soon as it's fertilized and consciousness connects to it, then it's being nourished by the nutrients within the cell. And when consciousness connects to it, then there is a contact which arises. That contact is a result of the prior craving which brought about the arising of this first moment of consciousness. There is a volition in that first moment of consciousness. That volition, again, it's a nutriment. And there is that first moment of consciousness itself, which is resulting from prior craving. That first moment of consciousness is a nutriment which nourishes the whole life process going on at that very first moment of conception. And then once that process of life begins, throughout the whole course of life, we have physical food within the body, nourishing the body, contact nourishing the arising of feelings, perceptions, mental formations, mental volition nourishing consciousness, and consciousness nourishing the other three mental aggregates and nourishing the physical body, because consciousness is a support for the physical body. And so the functioning of this entire psychophysical organism, in which different components are nourishing, sustaining, replenishing other components, all comes about through that influence of craving from the prior existence that was not yet quenched, that craving has brought into being this new life, this new process of becoming. Okay, now, this statement of the Buddha that the four nutriments arise from craving. Okay, this one finds in other parts of this, in other passages in the suttas. But now the Buddha, this is quite interesting, that he takes this teaching on the four nutriments and he raises, by pointing out craving is the cause for the four nutriments, he next raises the question, what is the source for craving? And then he gives the answer, craving has feeling as its source. And then this feeling, what is its source? Feeling has contact as its source. And so on. And so what the Buddha has done is to take the teaching on the four nutriments and grafted it onto the teaching of dependent origination. And so he now, from that teaching on the four nutriments, by inquiring into conditions, into causes, he leads us into the familiar standard 12-facted formula of dependent origination. But instead of beginning as usual, as he usually does with old age and death, then going to birth, then back to existence, then back to clinging, then from clinging back to craving, he's just started with the four nutriments, then gone from the four nutriments to craving. Then from craving, craving has feeling as its source. Feeling has contact as its source. Contact has the sixfold base, or better, it's more comprehensible to say the six sense bases as its source. And the six sense bases have what as their source? The six sense bases have nama-rupa, mentality, materiality, name and form as their source. Name and form, mentality, materiality have consciousness, that's vijnana, as its source. And consciousness has the volitional formations as its source. And the volitional formations have what as their source? The volitional formations have ignorance as their source, ignorance as their origin. They are born and produced from ignorance. So now the Buddha has taken that chain of conditions all the ways back to ignorance. Okay, now having brought it back to ignorance, he's going to bring it forward in the normal, using the normal formula all the ways down to the normal ending point. Here I'll give very concise explanation of dependent origination, and I'll treat it a little more elaborately next week. Okay. With ignorance as condition, the volitional formations come to be. Okay, because a person has ignorance, a person engages in actions, wholesome, this is mundane, a person engages in actions which may be unwholesome actions or mundane wholesome actions. And all of those actions have a certain potency a potency to produce results that correspond to the nature of those actions. Those actions are the volitional formations, or we can say that they generate volitional formations. And those volitional formations that occur along with the action, that express the action, that motivate the action, are conditions for consciousness, for the consciousness that exists along with themselves. So in one sense, we could say volitional formations are a condition for the consciousness that arises simultaneously with themselves. And they give their own color to that consciousness as being unwholesome or wholesome. But those volitional formations also have the capacity or potential to produce a consciousness. Let me put it this way. They have the potential to bring about the arising of consciousness after death in a new form of existence. They have the potential to regenerate the stream of consciousness in a new form of existence. Okay, so this is what is meant by volitional formations as a condition for consciousness. And it's what's especially indicated there is how the fact that volitional formations bring about this renewal of consciousness in the process of rebirth. Then when consciousness rearises, it brings along with itself nama-rupa, mentality, materiality. Or actually, one could say that consciousness has to, in the case of a human rebirth, animal rebirths, consciousness has to connect with some material form. That would be the fertilized egg. And then when consciousness connects with the fertilized egg, then it turns it into a living organism. And then the other mental factors arise, feeling, perception, the mental formations, that is mentality. So in this way, consciousness is the condition for mentality, materiality, for nama-rupa. Then as nama-rupa, mentality, materiality matures, this is in the human rebirth, matures in the womb, the six sense bases start to develop. Actually, at rebirth, there's already the body base and the mind base. But as the organism develops, the other sense bases, eye, ear, nose, tongue, start to mature. In the case of certain beings like devas, who have spontaneous or immediate rebirth, they say that the six sense bases come into being all at once. Okay, with the six sense bases as condition, there is contact with consciousness is able to make contact with the different sense objects. Through contact, there is feeling. Then, when there is ignorance and feeling, then craving arises. Through craving, there comes clinging. That is, clinging is an intense holding to the objects that one obtains through craving, or a continual obsession with objects that one doesn't obtain, or a clinging to views. Okay, clinging is the condition for what is here called being or existence, which is rather obscure, but as stated, but what is really meant, this is according to the way the whole tradition understands it, is that through clinging as a condition, one starts to engage once again in those activities which become the karmic causes for new existence in the future. So what is meant here by being or existence is the karmically active side of existence, that is, engaging in those karmic activities that will produce a new state of existence in the future. And then with those karmic activities as condition, and with the underlying causes of ignorance and craving, there takes place birth. With birth as condition, there is aging and death. And then along with birth, along with the life process, there comes sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Okay, maybe I should stop at this point and then ask if there are any questions. We'll go over the chain of causation again next week. Next week I plan to have a little table to show some of the relationships more clearly. Yeah, please.
Can you go over again craving as the source for the nutrients? I'm not quite sure on how craving gives rise to edible food.
How craving gives rise to
edible food.
In the common sense way?
Yeah.
Okay. I said in the common sense way, of course, craving doesn't actually give rise to edible food, since edible food, it's already there. But it's craving that sort of makes edible food something of like an object of obsession. Like for a person, whether they have craving or not, they need edible food. Like even an arhant who has completely overcome craving, if an arhant doesn't eat, no life.
So is it if craving gives rise to maybe the objectification of food? Or obsession?
Yeah, well, food, it depends what's meant by objectification.
Yeah, I got half what you're saying. And
it turns food into something that attracts the mind, that one becomes interested in different flavors, different tastes. We have this reflection on food that a monk is supposed to use, patisankha yoniso pindapatang patisevami neva devaya namadaya namandanaya navibhusanaya pindapatang patisevami patisankha yoniso pindapatang patisevami neva devaya namadaya, not for fun, not for, it's literally not for intoxication. That means not getting drunk on it.
Practice.
Yeah, it's just to support the practice. Okay, so, but when there's craving, then the food gets used for those other purposes, for fun, enjoyment, amusement, to satisfy one's craving for different tastes.
Can you explain how this works with an arahant? Like, I mean, is he craving food, or is it, does he get hungry?
He gets hungry. This biological hunger is unavoidable. But he would not have craving for food. How is possible to have hunger without feeling it as a tanha, a craving? I don't know, apart from the fact that he wouldn't have this thought about wanting to indulge in different tastes and try different flavors. But certainly the physical organism will experience hunger.
Along those same lines, is craving the same as desire? Is it unwholesome desire?
Yeah, this word desire is very tricky because, and it leads to quite a few misunderstandings of Buddha, misunderstandings and misrepresentations, because in Buddhism, in Buddhist terminology, there's another word for desire, which is the word in Pali, the word chanda. Now, sometimes the word chanda is used almost as a synonym for craving, and in that case, it's something unwholesome. But chanda is also used in a neutral sense, in which it's simply a ethically neutral motivating factor. You know, desire to move, desire to do any kind of action. That is just this neutral type of desire. And then there's the Buddha's a positive evaluation of desire. This is called the wholesome desire. And this is a desire that the Buddha very, very strongly encourages. It's the desire, you know, to overcome the unwholesome, to develop the wholesome, the desire to achieve, to perfect all of these different factors of enlightenment. All of that is desire. Yeah. I would call craving blind, egotistical, self-centered, selfish desire. Yeah.
Does dependent origination, can that also instead of going from life to life, go from moment to moment also?
Yep. Dependent origination works at many different levels. So the principle of dependent origination works in many, many ways. The 12-factored principle of or formula of dependent origination, the way it's taught in the suttas, the way I understand it, it extends over several lives. In the Abhidhamma, this formula is taken with certain variations, and it's shown how it applies within a single mind moment and how it works at the level of individual mind moments. And so it has these different applications. And then also the same principle of dependent origin. We'll actually see next week that there is what I call the principle of dependent origination and then the formula of dependent origination. And the principle of dependent origination is something that is not confined to any particular standard doctrinal formula, but it can be applied in many, many different ways. The principle is simply the principle of independence upon one thing, something else arises when that which is the necessary condition doesn't arise, or when it ceases, the dependently originated state doesn't arise or ceases. Any further questions? Okay, then we will end for the evening, and we'll end by sharing the merits with the devas, the nagas, the buddhas, and with all beings. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe sata anumodantu.